Hey there, I'm Sisha, and I study systems and synthetic biology.
Hey, I'm Stella, and I'm a computational pharmacologist.
Today, we're getting into some hazy topics.
And since things could get cloudy, we thought we'd take a joint effort in uncovering some truths in the world of cannabis.
This is Carry the One.
Carry the One Radio, the science podcast.
Igniting scientific curiosity.
From the University of California,
San Francisco.
Hey Stella, why are we talking about cannabis today?
Well, Sisha, cannabis, also known as marijuana, pot, weed, which I'm sure I will use interchangeably throughout this podcast, has been a blazing topic for a while now. And although it has a lot of restrictions, it remains the most widely used illegal drug in the world.
Yeah, globally, a bunch of countries, including Canada, South Africa, Georgia, and Uruguay, have legalized cannabis for both recreational and medical purposes. And the rest of the world, for the most part, classifies it as illegal, with a few nations having it decriminalized for personal use or medical use only.
Yeah, take, for example, the Netherlands. It's legal for medical use and decriminalized for personal use. You can actually get them at licensed coffee shops. But meanwhile, in Singapore, the possession or consumption of cannabis can result in fines or time in prison.
And even here in the U.S., even though it's illegal federally, it's allowed for recreational use in 11 states, including here in California.
Cannabis use is continually increasing. In fact, did you know that cannabis dispensaries in California are deemed as essential services during this shelter in place for COVID-19?
Yeah, I saw that. It seems like we've come a long way. And now people, especially celebrities, are more open about using it.
It's a good thing that you bring that up, because a good example is Pete Davidson. He's been very open about his use of cannabis as a pain reliever for his Crohn's disease. He talks a lot about cannabis in his stand-up comedy, and I actually watched his recent interview with Charlemagne the God, where he endorses weed as the only drug that people should consume. So when Charlemagne was asking him, like, what's your advice to people to not use drugs? And he says, just smoke weed. Don't do drugs. Just smoke weed. Isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
It's a drug.
It is a drug. That is super crazy. And that also touches on an idea that I see in my daily life as well. Like, a lot of people assume that cannabis is this harmless substance, but I mean, exactly like what you said, it's still a drug.
Yeah, it's a drug, and it's a drug that we don't know a lot of things about.
Exactly. So for this episode, we reached out to two cannabis researchers to learn more.
Our first guest is neurobiologist Dr. Stephen Laviolette, who is not only studying cannabis as it relates to mental health disorders, but also discovering its potential as a therapy.
Super interesting. And then our other guest is physician Dr. Salome Kehani, who's studying the relationship between smoking cannabis and cardiovascular events.
In this episode, we will get some insight into the types of research done on cannabis, what the industry looks like, funding, hurdles to its research, and potential future research opportunities, as well as some important takeaways from the findings from both Dr. Laviolette and Dr. Kehani.
Before we get into the interviews, it's only fair that we delve into the weeds with some information about cannabis.
Well, for one, it's a drug from a cannabis plant, which causes changes in various biological processes, both mentally and physically.
Yeah, and this is because it contains psychoactive compounds, which means compounds that alter the brain to cause changes in how you feel, perceive things, and behave. So as you would imagine, cannabis is used for both medical and recreational purposes.
There are so many ways to consume cannabis, and these methods affect how it moves throughout the body and how long it exerts its psychoactive effects.
Yeah, if you inhale cannabis by smoking or vaping, a person could start to feel its effects within minutes. By 15 or 30 minutes, the effect can get to its maximum activity, and then it dwindles over a couple hours.
Yeah, and if you're taking it as an edible, whether in cookies or gummies or brownies, there's so many ways to eat it. Not that I know. It takes longer to feel the effects. They'll start to feel some effects starting maybe half an hour to an hour after eating it. The maximum effect would be maybe 2 or 3 hours after, and it could last as long as 4 more hours, just depending on how much you dose or eat.
And cannabis is made up of at least 113 types of chemicals called cannabinoids. The most notable of these are tetrahydrocannabinol, THC for short, and cannabidiol, or CBD for short.
Yeah, both THC and CBD have been explored in treatment of different conditions, such as pain, anxiety, insomnia, and low appetite. What's different is that THC, unlike CBD, actually gives the psychoactive high effect.
Yeah, and what's happening in the body is that the cannabinoids from plants actually mimic the body's natural chemicals called endocannabinoids. And normally these endocannabinoids bind to and activate one of the cannabinoid receptors in the nervous system. And when a person consumes cannabis, its cannabinoids compete for the receptors with the body's natural cannabinoid.
Although cannabinoid receptors are mainly found on nerve cells in the brain and spinal cord, it can be found in other organs and tissues, including the heart, spleen, reproductive system, and gastrointestinal tract.
Yeah, and surprisingly, despite marijuana being so relevant in our society, we still know so little about it. And marijuana is becoming increasingly legalized, and it's increasing in use. And so it's super important for research to be carried out to study like the potential positive or negative effects. And so to learn about one of the efforts in cannabis research, let's move on to our first interview.
Welcome back to Care the One Radio. I'm Stella, and it's my pleasure to introduce to you our first interviewee, Dr. Stephen Laviolette from London, not that London, Canada. Stephen has been specializing in cannabis research for over 10 years. Hi, Stephen. Please can you introduce yourself to our listeners and tell us about the types of questions that you're focused on answering about cannabis?
Yeah, I'm a professor at the University of Western Ontario in the Schulich School of Medicine and Dentistry. And I'm in the Department of Anatomy and Cell Biology, and I'm also in the Department of Psychiatry. I've been a neurobiologist for about 25 years now, and we've been specializing in cannabis research for about 15 years now. We've also been strongly focused on cannabinoids, and not only mapping out how the cannabinoid receptor system controls emotional processing in the brain, but then we started looking more at specific compounds in marijuana. So marijuana, of course, has over 100 different biochemicals in it. So we've been focusing mostly on THC, which is the major psychoactive compound. And then a lot of our research is now looking at CBD or cannabidiol, which I'm sure you've heard of as well.
Yeah, I'm interested in what your findings are for THC. From what I know, while it's beneficial in treating some conditions, it's also linked to a number of the negative side effects that you usually hear about in some people.
Yeah, it totally depends on the individual. Some people will actually have very few side effects or no side effects at all, or just experience positive effects. They might feel more relaxed and more euphoric after taking THC or cannabis strains that might have higher levels of THC. On the other hand, some people do experience paranoia. Paranoia is probably the most commonly reported side effect. Some people can even develop vomiting disorders associated with high THC concentrations, some memory impairments, increased anxiety. And again, we're sort of at a point where we don't really understand who's more or less vulnerable to those sorts of things. There isn't sort of a magic screening that we can give someone and let them know if you smoke marijuana, you're more likely to experience paranoia or you're more likely to experience the more positive effects of marijuana.
Exactly. There's no data to predict these effects in people, but I'm pretty sure that by 10 years from now, there will be some data, especially with the legalization, its increasing use, and also that there's more research initiatives to look into cannabis. Can you tell us about what you've observed in your work on THC?
Yeah, about 5 years ago, we started getting interested in how adolescent exposure to THC might increase the risk of developing certain mental health problems like schizophrenia. That's sort of the major clinical finding with chronic adolescent exposure to THC. So we have some animal models where we give adolescent rodents high levels of THC, and then we look at how that affects their brain development going forward. And sure enough, we find that adolescent THC exposure causes a lot of the same molecular and behavioral changes that we find in schizophrenia as well.
Wow, that's super interesting. We certainly don't know much about the long-term effects, or at least have it documented and studied. I also saw that you're looking at the prenatal exposure to THC. What have you found there?
That's a more recent collaboration we have here at the university. And we're looking at how prenatal exposure to cannabis might lead to long-term deficits in the offspring, because there's some evidence that anywhere from 10 to 20% of pregnant women are now smoking marijuana to alleviate, you know, morning sickness or anxiety and whatnot. But we don't really know anything about the long-term effects. So we've been looking a lot now at how prenatal exposure might be causing some unwanted side effects later on in life.
I imagine that you're testing this with rodents. Do you have plans to move into humans?
Yeah, we use rats as our primary animal model. We are moving into more human clinical work as well. So we are setting up brain organoids. You might have heard of mini brains. We're getting some cell samples from patients that have schizophrenia, and we're basically recapitulating brains from those patients in culture. And we're looking at how cannabinoids might be involved in some of those same abnormal processes in brain development that might be linked to early fetal brain development.
So you're essentially taking cells from patients and developing them into little blobs of cells that make these miniature brains. These mini brains are then more representative of the human tissue environment.
Yeah. So that's sort of a more human aspect of things. And then the other angle is we are trying to get some clinical trials up and going as well to look at possibly reversing some of the negative effects of adolescent cannabis exposure to see if we can reverse some of those negative side effects in people that are experiencing long-term psychiatric side effects if they had started smoking marijuana when they were still adolescents. But that's sort of longer term in the future.
That's really cool. So through your work on THC, you found evidence suggesting that prenatal and chronic adolescent exposure to THC could increase the risk of developing detrimental long-term effects. And now you're making efforts in the direction of reversing some of these negative effects. Besides THC, you're also studying CBD, the compound believed to have fewer or no negative side effects. What do you hope to uncover from your research on CBD?
So we've been looking at how CBD can modulate the formation of traumatic memories. So again, this is using a rodent model of PTSD. And we were able to show that if you administer CBD into an area of the brain, which is part of the brain's dopamine system, you can block the formation of traumatic memories and also the recall of traumatic memories. So that has important implications for CBD being a possible treatment for PTSD, because the primary problem in PTSD is this intrusive recall of traumatic memories. Ultimately, we need to sort of move that into clinical trials as well to see if there's any replication in human populations.
So far, it seems that CBD has this potential to modulate both the formation and recall of traumatic memories by this way of administering into the brain's dopamine system. And dopamine, it's an important chemical compound in the body that serves not only as a hormone or neurotransmitter that's transmitting all these signals in the nervous system, plays a big role in the thinking, working memory, and memory retention. So I'm thinking if you can actually replicate this in humans, it could be really highly impactful for treating individuals with PTSD. So far, your approaches to studying THC and CBD show that cannabis is very complex and we still have so much to uncover.
There's a huge complexity to the plant that's somewhat overwhelming. And one of the reasons why we're only starting to get a grasp of it now is because it's really hard to do this research, because you have to go through a lot of government red tape in order to access these compounds. So a lot of research labs are not willing to go through the hassle of dealing with all of the regulations and the government restrictions that are imposed on this sort of research. So that's really slowed things down. But where we are now, what we do appreciate is that the plant is much more complicated than we originally thought. It's going to take decades to really tease everything apart and figure out what's really going on.
Historically, drugs like marijuana and other related compounds have been difficult to study, and these are for reasons that are related to the drug's acceptability for medical use and also the drug's abuse and dependency potential. So in the U.S., cannabis is still considered a Schedule 1 drug alongside heroin, LSD, ecstasy, and magic mushrooms. Schedule 1 is this category that's reserved for drugs with high potential for abuse. And as a Schedule 1 drug, it has the strictest regulation where it's illegal except for research. This is obviously not evolving alongside the public attitudes and research findings, and perhaps more scientific research is actually needed to at least show evidence of its medical value. So Canada became the second country after Uruguay to legalize cannabis, and that was in October 2018. Can you comment on whether regulation and drug research is lagging behind policy changes?
Yeah, I mean, the cannabis research community in Canada is pretty small, but we all know each other, so we all sort of interact with each other. And of course, we were hoping that with legalization, the research would be a lot easier. But the irony is that it's actually become somewhat more difficult, because now we need to apply for another license to do the research. and the government is really backlogged. So there's a lot of labs that are still waiting in line to get their license, and there's research on hold. And we were lucky because we were one of the first people to apply for it. And even then, it took us 7 months to get it. So in many ways, it was actually easier to do the research before it was legalized in terms of the red tape we had to go through, which is kind of ironic, but that's unfortunately the way it sort of worked out. Hopefully it's going to get more streamlined in the future, but we're still waiting to see what's going to happen.
Wow, that's pretty ironic. You know, you would expect it to be easier once it's legal, but yeah, it's definitely lagging. But at this point, once you actually get approved to carry out research on cannabis, what forms are you testing? I imagine you're getting pure extracts. Am I correct?
Yeah, you need to get purified pharmaceutical grade extract. The other issue is that it's really expensive to get them because the process of extracting them and getting them to pharmaceutical grade is extremely expensive. So you need to have a lot of funding in your grant in order to actually afford to get the purified THC or CBD, because it's not trivial to get those extracted.
Yeah, exactly. That sounds reasonable. But also in the case of the different breeds or strains of the cannabis plant, how do you account for those? Are you studying the strains or are you just looking at varying concentrations of THC and CBD?
Yeah, so that's what we do primarily. So we take purified CBD or purified THC, and then we combine it together. And sometimes we'll add terpenes to that as well, to basically create a formula based on the purified compounds.
And by terpenes, these are the compounds in marijuana that give it its flavors and aromas?
Yeah, because using whole plant extracts, it's really impossible to know how much of each compound the animal might be getting. So in order to properly control for that experimentally, we sort of have no choice but to use the purified extracts and then very carefully develop formulas and ratios for the THC and CBD or whatever we want to add to it to make sure that it's controlled for across all of the subjects and that we're very consistent in how we're administering these different compounds.
So I wanted to touch back on a topic that you hinted at earlier. You were mentioning that compounds are extremely expensive. How hard is it now to get funding to study cannabis?
We've been pretty lucky, I would say. I think that it's easier to get funded if you're looking at it from sort of a negative health perspective. If you're making the argument that it's therapeutic and can help certain disorders, then I think the medical community is more critical. They're still very critical of that, especially the psychiatric community. So it is a bit of a hurdle because there is this implicit bias against cannabis as a potential treatment option.
I mean, this is a very good point, seeing as cannabis carries a stigma.
A large part of that is because most psychiatrists in everyday practice, all they see are the negative things. They're seeing people come in with psychosis that are related to cannabis, and they're not really seeing the positive impact that cannabis can have in some people's lives for treating certain disorders like anxiety or PTSD or depression.
I think it's pretty ironic how there's a flip situation with getting approval to do cannabis research in Canada, where it's actually legal. Hopefully, with time, this improves because there is a lot of catching up to do and more needs to be done to normalize the research in cannabis, no matter the proposed research questions, whether looking at the positive effects or the negative effects. It should not be something that's limiting research.
Yes, exactly. There's still this cultural hesitance toward accepting research that looks at the more positive aspects of cannabinoids. So that's definitely a challenge for, I think, anyone in any part of the world right now.
You had mentioned that the cannabis research community is very small. Who are you mostly working with or collaborating with? Do you have any industry or government collaborations?
Yeah, we do. So we have government funding and we have quite a bit of industry funding as well. Canada has a huge multi-billion dollar cannabis industry, and it's sort of hard to keep track of it because they're all sort of buying each other up and it's hard to know who owns what and whatnot.
The U.S. cannabis industry has a current value of about $9.2 billion, and this is projected to grow to $57 billion by 2027. There are many companies, especially here in the Bay Area, that are developing methods for how to consume cannabis, whether it's vape pens, edibles, creams. There's also money coming from delivery to consumers because, you know, they're providing a service. There's also some efforts where I've seen people taking classes for how to cultivate cannabis and its related compounds. One such as hemp, it's like a sister cousin to cannabis and part of this industry as well. Is that something that you see in Canada as well? What are people in the industry interested in producing or researching?
I think the industry is starting to realize that the companies that are going to be most successful are the ones that can offer effective products to their clients that have some scientific validity to them and that stand out from the rest of the crowd. So there's a lot of interest now in funding research that looks at specific formulations of cannabinoids, and companies want to patent those formulations and be able to sell them exclusively to their clients. So that's sort of where the industry side of things is right now, I think.
Speaking of patenting formulations, I read that you're also involved in a company called CannaQuest, and this is a company that's developing health products from cannabis and botanical oil extracts. Can you tell me a bit more about that?
Yeah, so we've been working with CannaQuest for a couple years now. We're developing formulations of THC, for example, that don't produce the side effects that are associated with regular THC. So we're adding certain botanicals and other compounds to the THC to reduce some of those side effects that are associated with THC. The full patent is, I believe, completed now. So they've already patented one of their formulations. And then we're also looking at how synergizing CBD with different ingredients and formulations and whatnot might improve the efficacy of CBD for certain disorders as well.
Wow, that's great. Are these formulations mainly for psychiatric disorders?
Yeah, primarily mental health side effects.
This is an interesting approach, given how we had previously discussed the potential drawbacks of high THC exposure. So working to get the right ratio of THC and CBD is key for a number of mental health applications. So I'm very interested in seeing what other formulations that scientists and companies are developing with cannabis constituents like CBD and THC. We barely scratched the surface on cannabis research, and I'm excited to see what kinds of research will be done later on, 10 years from now even. What do you think are the most pressing questions to explore in this field?
Yeah, I think it's going to come down to figuring out how these different compounds work together and how do they work together in a way that can be more specifically targeted to certain symptoms and certain disorders. So for example, does a certain ratio of THC and CBD have greater efficacy as a treatment for addiction versus a treatment for anxiety versus a treatment for PTSD, and then combining different compounds in the plant as well, do those also modulate the efficacy of those specific cannabinoids? So that's sort of, I think, one of the pressing questions right now. And also, as I said, moving more towards genomic screening to identify people that may or may not benefit from cannabis and those people who might be at greater risk for suffering from some of the negative side effects.
Yes, I think finding out what makes individuals different and more prone to these negative effects would be very interesting. But what about opioids? Are researchers also interested in developing formulations that can be substitutes for them, seeing as opioids, the primary treatment for pain, have a very high addiction potential?
Yeah, so the clinical data about how cannabinoids are effective for our pain are somewhat controversial. If you sort of do an analysis of all the studies, then it doesn't look to be that effective. But we obviously know from anecdotal studies that a lot of patients in chronic pain are reporting that cannabinoids can be just as effective as opioids, and obviously without all of the negative addiction effect.
Yeah, exactly. I think with more research, it would be less controversial, and there might be more agreement on whether these compounds could actually be used for pain and actually be good substitutes for opioids. Another thing I wanted to ask is, I know the methods that most people are consuming cannabis have changed dramatically in the last 5 to 10 years, seeing that now there's vape pens, there's teas, there's gummies, there's bath salts, there's baked goods, everything else under the sun. How might things change in the future? Are we going to get any new delivery methods? Can you give us an inside scoop?
Yeah, that's another million-dollar question, especially with the edibles. So edibles have just become legal in Canada. The problem with edibles, of course, is that it takes several hours for them to be effective. So if someone's taking cannabinoid products for anxiety, you don't really want to be waiting 2 hours for the effects to kick in, especially if you're having a panic attack. So if you're taking it for pain, for example, you want more immediate effects. So I think the future is going to be developing more innovative delivery systems, so more effective vaporizers and even transdermal patches. Sublingual, you know, those dissolving strips. There's dozens of companies that are already working on that. And there's companies looking at nanoparticles, so encapsulating them in nanoparticles to see if that improves the bioavailability of the cannabinoids, because a lot of the cannabinoids get taken up in your digestive system before they even get a chance to get to the brain. There's a lot of companies that are now investing in novel delivery systems for cannabinoids.
So bioavailability is the proportion of a drug that makes it to the bloodstream and thus has an effect. So by shuttling the relevant cannabinoid in nanoparticles or tiny particles, which are like the width of human hair, these cannabinoids have a better chance of reaching circulation at a higher proportion. I'm really excited to see what happens in the next couple of years in the cannabis industry and also in research. I really enjoyed learning about your research. So you've been studying cannabis for at least 15 years. What has that experience been like for you?
I love doing this research because it's such a fascinating area, the cannabinoid system. And as I said, we're really still on the ground floor in terms of understanding what all these different cannabinoids are doing. So it would take several lifetimes to really explore to your satisfaction what all the questions you have. So it's sort of a scientist's dream because it's a never-ending challenge. So in that sense, I think that it's really sort of an exciting area to be in.
Yeah, as a scientist, I can definitely relate. It would be too boring if there's no challenge, right? What are some things that you would like to see moving forward with cannabis research?
It's still quite challenging to do this research. So I would like to see greater recognition from the government, especially given that it's legalized now. There really needs to be more investment in the research side of things. And there needs to be a more streamlined way of allowing researchers to do this sort of research. So that's my major beef right now.
I think that's a fair beef to have. Based on your work so far, what are the major takeaways that you would like our listeners to be aware of?
The most important findings from not only our research, but from the clinical research as well, is that developing brains should really stay away from THC as much as possible. There's clearly a risk associated with exposing yourself to high levels of THC during adolescence, and especially the developing baby as well. CBD is a totally different thing. CBD appears to have no negative side effects associated with, at least none that we're aware of. So if you are concerned about side effects from cannabis, then the best thing would be to sort of use a more balanced CBD and THC combination as opposed to exposing yourself to some of those higher THC concentration products that are out there. I think that's sort of the takeaway message. But for people that might be suffering from anxiety or from other sorts of mental health problems, I think there's in the future, there's going to be more validated clinical evidence to suggest that different formulas of cannabis are going to be helpful for treating a lot of those disorders. And also potentially opioid addiction and other forms of addiction. As the research is unfolding, we're starting to discover that THC and CBD might have some benefits in terms of serving as a replacement for some of those more dangerous addictive drugs. But again, we're still sort of waiting on a lot of the clinical trials to take us from the basic level of understanding to a more clinically relevant side of the equation.
This has been very interesting and informative. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me today.
Yeah, my pleasure. I think we covered a large amount of the important topics for sure.
So Stephen is interested in defining the effects of the different molecular components of cannabis, mainly CBD and THC.
Over time, he studied the effect of THC exposure in neurodevelopment during adolescence and even in the prenatal stage.
He also examined CBD in relation to the formation and recall of memories, which suggests avenues for the treatment of neuropsychiatric illnesses like PTSD.
We learned from Stephen the importance of adolescent brains being vulnerable to the effects of THC, potential uses of CBD for PTSD treatment, and also the future of improving cannabis research by including genomics.
I have to say, it was really interesting to find out that opposite effect of legalization on funding, huh?
Yeah, it feels really counterintuitive.
There's still so much to be discovered, and it's critical as there's so many people who use cannabis products.
I definitely agree.
Well, we're not done yet. We also spoke to Dr. Salome Kehani, who is a physician and public health researcher. Let's see what she has to say.
Take it away, Sish.
Welcome back. It's my pleasure to introduce you all to our next interviewee. Hi, Dr. Kehani. Can you please introduce yourself to our listeners and give us an overview of your research interests?
Sure. My name is Salome Kehani. I'm an internist and a health services and health outcomes researcher. And in the past few years, I've been really interested in examining the health effects of cannabis.
How did you become interested in studying cannabis?
Actually, I remember the day that I really got interested in studying the health effects of cannabis. I had not thought about cannabis at all. I was in my car listening to KQED, and somebody came on and said, you know, wouldn't it be great if the tobacco companies got in the business of selling cannabis, because if instead of selling death, they would be selling this herb, this, you know, life. And I reflected on that. I actually started laughing. I thought that was a terrible idea, that the tobacco companies get interested in anything and try to commercialize anything. I thought that would be a terrible idea. But I think after that moment, I started becoming cognizant of what was going on around me and sort of noticing that, you know, when I go to public places, there seems to be a lot of people smoking cannabis, and that some of my friends talk about it as if there's absolutely no harms. And I came back, you know, and started noticing among my patients that they talked about it as if this was some sort of not only not harmful, beneficial substance. And started thinking, well, have I really seen any evidence to that effect? And I started looking at the literature and realizing that an awfully limited amount has been published on the health effects of cannabis, specifically the harms.
You mentioned the health effects of cannabis are understudied. What types of negative health effects do you usually observe?
The way I think about it is that there's two potential harms from cannabis, at least two. One is from the smoking of cannabis. The vast majority of users of cannabis smoke cannabis. The other is actually the psychoactive properties of THC. And there's evidence to suggest that it's associated with psychosis. There's evidence that it might interfere with the treatment of mental health conditions like depression and anxiety. So I think that there are potential effects that are from using edible forms of cannabis as well, and specifically high concentration THC cannabis.
Wow. It sounds like the relationship between mental health conditions and cannabis is quite complex. It does seem like the negative effects of cannabis aren't highlighted as much, especially in reference to the act of inhaling smoke in general. Going along with that idea, I know you also study public perceptions of cannabis. How did you become interested in that?
I had this one patient, I'll never forget, he had a heart attack. And I had always thought of him as rather like one of my healthier patients. I mean, he exercised an hour a day, you know, he took his cholesterol pill. I really didn't expect him to have a heart attack. I mean, it could happen to anybody, but it was low risk in my view. So, you know, he told me, yeah, the ambulance picked, you know, he was picked up by ambulance, taken to the hospital. And he was telling me the story, and I was just sort of in my head going over his risk factors. And I asked him, well, you don't smoke, do you? He said, oh, no. And I said, and then he said, well, not tobacco. And I said, well, what do you mean? And he told me that he smoked marijuana. And I said, well, that's smoking too. And he said to me, well, that's, you know, that's not harmful. And it's true that we don't have data that says smoking cannabis causes cardiovascular events. We have very few studies that have looked at this question. And to my knowledge, only one that has examined it. And that one small study did find an effect on cardiovascular events. But it was very interesting to me that he assumed that because this was cannabis, he described it to me as an herb. Well, it's no different. And, you know, it was very interesting to me because, you know, at least from my thinking, you know, smog causes cardiovascular events, forest fires cause cardiovascular events, secondhand smoke causes cardiovascular events. Why wouldn't smoking cannabis cause cardiovascular events?
That's a fair point. Cannabis is often referred to as an herb, but tobacco is also a plant after all, and so natural doesn't always mean healthy. Do you often hear your patients make a distinction between the smoke from tobacco and the smoke from cannabis?
You know, I've heard from many people that, for example, that smoking cannabis doesn't have the same harms as smoking tobacco. And I was always wondering, well, where does this idea come from? And the article is a very interesting article published in the Journal of American Medical Association. And this article is based on the Cardia study, in which they followed a few thousand people over time, and they measured their cannabis use. And they examined the association of cannabis use with pulmonary function. And they concluded that at low amounts of use, that there's no effect on the lungs. And I think the low amounts of exposure is the operating, you know, the thing that we should be very interested in. What does that actually mean? And when you go and look in the study, the average person smoked one or two times a month in 26 years. So one or two times a month over 26 years, if you smoked one or two cigarettes over 26 years, you would not get deficits in pulmonary function either. And I think that if we're talking about one or two times a month, yes, probably not associated with deficits in pulmonary function. But if we're talking about daily use and multiple times a day, then that's probably not true. And we don't have data, a lot of data on that. So we have very few studies that have high levels of exposure over long periods of time to understand what the effects are. So I think that there wasn't that much information, and the information we had, we couldn't really extrapolate it to how people might be using it today.
I see. So it doesn't really seem like a fair comparison then. Were there other significant differences in how those studies were conducted and how cannabis is commonly consumed today?
Well, the THC in those studies was at 7%, 3% to 7%. Now we have 100, we're selling 100%, concentrated THC to the public. And, you know, the studies that said there was no harms from smoking, there were very little exposure. So perhaps if you smoke that way, I mean, I think what made tobacco so harmful was the commercialization and the public health messaging that the tobacco companies, they put a lot of money into promoting tobacco use and to manufacturing a form of tobacco that was highly addictive. With commercialization, there's always that risk that the cannabis that's sold to the public becomes more addictive, more concentrated, and that people start using it more and more. That's the concern, really, that higher amounts of use might lead to a lot of harm.
Right, because with more frequent use, there can be a higher risk of developing a substance use disorder, for instance. From a public perception standpoint, that must be an important point. So it makes sense that the perceptions on cannabis differ substantially between younger and older generations too, since there are some younger folks who have only known cannabis as a recreationally legal substance.
It was very interesting to me. And this thought about perceptions, I mean, I have a daughter and I would take her out to public places, and it just seemed that there was secondhand smoke everywhere. And I could smell cannabis everywhere, and I was wondering, well, do people have a different understanding towards cannabis? And do they think it's less harmful, like the smoke from cannabis is less harmful? So we designed a study and looked across a sample of the U.S. population to see if, and try to capture some of these perceptions to see whether people did think actually that it's less harmful, that tobacco smoke was more harmful than cannabis smoke and cannabis, you know. So we did look and we found that that was true, that people did think that smoke from cannabis was less harmful.
In her research, Dr. Kahani has shown that people often put smoking cannabis in a separate category than smoking tobacco, even though the cardiovascular effects of inhaling smoke in general could lead to negative health effects. In future studies, it could be really interesting to separate the effects of cannabis from the effects of the smoke itself. What happens when cannabis is eaten as an edible, for instance? What happens when there are different ratios of CBD or THC? For that, we'll have to see what research shows down the line. Have you encountered any challenges when looking at the health effects of cannabis?
It depends on what kind of question you want to ask, right? If you want to ask whether using cannabis is good for sleep and you want to do a trial, that's the kind of study that you'd need actually a lot of approvals in addition to just getting your grant funded. In my case, you really can't randomize somebody to a substance that, you know, you think might have harms. So in my case, getting a grant to look at, you know, what people are doing already and following them over time and comparing them to people that are not, you know, in this case, smoking marijuana, doesn't have much barriers, the barriers to actually get the funding. My work is observational, so it's not difficult at all to do observational research. The challenge is when you want to do a trial. Right now, they have to get multiple permissions to get the form of cannabis that the NIH makes available to the researchers. You can only use that, and you have to go through multiple stages of approval to be able to launch a trial. So it's very sort of cumbersome to do clinical trials. But it depends on what kind of question you want to ask.
So what does an observational study generally look like?
What we did, the way we designed the study was, you know, there's sometimes like trials are done in which they look at high-risk populations, do their medication work in a high-risk population. The way we designed it is, you know, if you really wanted to ask the question, does cannabis, smoking cannabis cause cardiovascular events, you need an awfully large sample of people followed over a very long time. So we designed the sample as in a high-risk group. Like, who is at most risk of having a cardiovascular event? Well, people that are older, over 65, people that already have heart disease. So we're looking among people that are older with coronary, veterans that are older with coronary disease, and comparing them to people that have coronary disease and don't smoke. So smokers compared to non-smokers, we're comparing them, yeah.
That's a cool way to conduct a study, since really you're just monitoring the health effects like coronary, that is heart disease, in patients who already smoke cannabis. What other types of health outcomes do you measure?
We've done a series of systematic reviews where we've basically summarized all the evidence around the cardiovascular health effects of cannabis, the observational studies, and we've looked at the effect of marijuana use on cardiovascular events, the respiratory effects of marijuana use, and we also looked at the associated marijuana use with development of cancer. And it's sort of a collection of the evidence. And why we did this was because we want to see what we know and what we don't know. And that was very helpful to us in sort of designing our research program to see what kind of questions we should answer. So we've done a series of at least three systematic reviews so far on that.
There are many challenges working with a substance that can potentially be harmful in research studies. Dr. Kayani described a couple ways of working around these challenges, like an observational study, which follows the health outcomes of patients who already do or don't smoke cannabis. Observational studies like these can be really difficult to control. You could imagine that cannabis use differs a lot between individuals, and this can make results difficult to interpret. But you can still learn a lot of valuable information correlating health risk to use. So where do you see the cannabis field going from here? What are the next steps?
Well, I think that it's there's so many aspects that are unanswered. And I think that, I mean, just on the health effects alone, there's the harms, and you know, there's a lot of people that are looking at the effects of CBD and as a drug, and therapeutic forms of THC and CBD. And as you pointed out, the effects of different forms. I think that we're in the infancy of studying cannabis, and I think that what I always tell people, as you can see a sign on my desk that says "absence of evidence is not evidence of absence," and I think that what the public may be misunderstanding is that we don't have a lot of data on cannabis, and that people assume that that means that it's safe and there's no harms. But in fact, all it means is we haven't studied it. I think there's multiple facets to explore, and I think it's going to take us a very long time to understand sort of the health effects of cannabis and the public health ramifications of legalization.
So Dr. Kayani focuses on the clinical outcomes of cannabis smoking in her patients. And we learned from her that the perceived harms of cannabis differs based on age group, and that we should be cautious of potential detrimental effects of smoking cannabis because the past literature had some limitations.
Right. People often separate smoke from cannabis versus smoke from tobacco, but the smoke itself could be harmful to organs like the heart.
And Stephen and Dr. Kayani had quite different approaches to cannabis research, huh?
Yeah, totally. Stephen seemed really excited about characterizing THC and CBD and creating formulations that could be used therapeutically. So he was looking more at the positive uses of it. So he was thinking of things for treating PTSD, pain, and also ways to avoid these negative side effects. But Dr. Kayani's efforts were more focused on characterizing the risk of smoking cannabis itself. I think both perspectives are really important for the budding future of cannabis research. A joint effort, if you will.
Overall, we see that cannabis matters, and there's still much more to know. Bottom line, the absence of evidence is not the evidence of absence.
This episode was written and produced by Seisha Takagishi and myself, Stella Belonbu.
We thank Dr. LaViolette and Dr. Kayani for making time to speak with us and the rest of the Carry the One Radio team for their feedback on this episode. Special thanks to Adam Malgoza at UCSF for fact-checking.
If you liked what you've heard and want to support the show, please tell people about us. And you can also donate to the show at patreon.com/carrytheone.
Just $1 a month goes a long way and would be a huge help. And if you feel like spending the big bucks, $3 will get you some great stickers.
We thank this episode's science producers, Sama Ahmed, Carly Van Orstel, Janine Cuevas, Judith Horn, and David Cabral for supporting us at the $5 a month or higher level.
With your support, we can expand our podcasting operations to bring you more content and improved audio quality. We'd also love to have the opportunity to teach science communication skills to local schools.
We also want to hear from you. If you like or love our podcast, leave a comment or a review. Find us on Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook and start a conversation.
We have more info on our website and over 110 episodes at carrytheoneradio.com. You can subscribe to Carry the One on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, Spotify, iTunes, SoundCloud, or wherever you get podcasts.
Tune in next month for our episode about dinosaurs and their discovery. And as always,
stay curious.